Welcome back to Dark Florida, the podcast where we explore eerie true crime, historical oddities, cryptid sightings, paranormal encounters, and the unexplained, right here in Florida and far beyond. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, and this week we're traveling back to the late 1800s, long before airplanes, before modern aviation, and before the term UFO even existed. This week's episode dives into one of the strangest and most forgotten waves of sightings in American history, the Great Airship Mystery. But before we get started, make sure you're following Dark Florida on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast, and you can find full episodes, investigations, and video content on YouTube at youtube.com/@darkflorida411. And if you have had a strange experience you'd like to share, or if you're interested in being a guest on the show, you can email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. And if you would like to support the podcast, you can visit buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. And be sure, wherever you're listening, to drop a 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. Now, turn down the lights, get comfortable, and let's look towards the sky, because this mystery begins long before modern flight. Welcome back to another episode of Dark Florida. This week, I am thrilled to welcome back a returning guest to the show, Mr. Michael Kirkpatrick, aka MK Ultra. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Brooke. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into tonight's topic. I know you have spent a lot of time digging into historical accounts, newspaper archives. You've read a lot of books on this subject, and we're going to talk about one of the strangest phenomena in early American history. So without further ado, this week, we're going to be diving into one of the most mysterious waves of sightings from the 1890s, which is the Great Airship Mystery. And we're going to explore what people saw, what they reported, and some of the theories that still baffle us today. So welcome to the show, MK.
Yeah, I'm really excited to go over this topic with you, because I think it's I'm just a kind of an amateur in this, but I find this whole topic so fascinating that it's really captured my interest, because it's not your standard UFO stuff at all, but it has been kind of like put in that category of UFO, but it's not.
Yeah, it has.
Much weirder.
Now, what originally pulled you into even researching this at all? What caught your attention about this?
I've always had an interest in like historical sightings and historical accounts of strange things of all manners. But particularly with the Great Airship Mystery of 1897, there was something about it where it captured my interest, because it didn't seem like it was some sort of extraterrestrial force. It seemed like there was people building aircraft and flying them around the country. And to me, that kind of gave like it's like a cool steampunk Wild Wild West kind of story. It's this old timey where most people are still on horses, but you have these people that are possibly building these great airships flying around the country.
Right. And to give some historical backdrop to what America was like in the 1890s, there was no powered flight yet. And the idea of having controlled flight like that was still something that felt a lot closer to science fiction than reality for most people at that time. This was post-Civil War era, and Americans were really fascinated by the idea of inventors. So the initial wave of the airship sightings took place in California on November 17th, 1896, and it wound up lasting until January of 1897. And while this was being reported, there were airships that were seen in over 19 states at the time. So this was pretty widespread for the era.
Yeah, it took place over a course of about 8 to 9 months. And it started in California, but then it quickly spread to the Midwest, to Texas. And even on the West Coast, it went as high as Washington, Vancouver. So it really was like an outbreak of these sightings. And it was just for a small window of time.
When we talk about the first initial sighting that happened in Sacramento, it was seen over the Capitol building, and several citizens observed this, and they were people of notable stature within the community. I want to say it was the governor's advisor who was one of the people who witnessed the phenomena as well.
Correct. His staff saw him, and he trusted his staff. They'd been with him for years, and they all described the exact same thing. So he took it very seriously. He believed that this was a real thing that they saw. At the time, there was a lot of talk that it was just a media hoax. But we'll get into that, I guess, later on in that avenue.
Yes, we'll definitely touch on the hoaxing aspect of this. But with the first initial sighting, the eyewitnesses reported that this craft was super low to the ground. They had mentioned it even got as low at about 100 feet to where they could hear voices from the craft. They were able to look inside, and what they described is four men or beings inside powering it. It looked like they were almost riding bicycles. And it should also be noted that at the time it was steering against the wind. So, but there was no obvious signs of propulsion besides it looked like they were inside, like powering the machine. Eyewitnesses were really able to get a good look at what they were seeing. It's described being this cigar-shaped long object with searchlights on either side and propellers.
Yeah, people describe propellers. The cigar shape itself was described as being about 200 feet long, and then it has some sort of substructure behind it. Which, now the San Francisco sightings are interesting because it kind of describes what would later become a Zeppelins in a way. But we're talking 60 years before this.
Right.
And we're talking about something that's quiet. It's not making any noise. And people seem to be operating pedals and wheels. This is another thing that comes up a lot in these sightings is people, regular people, operating machinery inside of it. And whatever power system they're using is somehow silent in a time period where the most efficient engine was a steam engine, which was too heavy to be lifted up by. And now at that time, there was hot air balloons, but there was nothing close to having the ability to lift up a steam engine. Of even a small steam engine was too heavy for anything like that. And diesel engines were in their very early prime at that point.
When we talk about flying machines in the 1800s, it's important that we're clear about what did and what didn't exist at that time. Because long before we did have airplanes, we were using hot air balloons during the Civil War. The Union Army used these hot air balloons that they called the Union Army Balloon Corps, and they were hydrogen-filled balloons that were tethered to the ground.
They could actually see the other side's armies, and then they could give good reconnaissance details back. And in fact, Colonel Mustard, famed Mustard, or Custard, I mean, he was actually part of that balloon corps, too, in the early days. And I'm glad we went back to the Civil War, because this is kind of where I think the story might even begin. The first hot air, or what it was called, lighter than air flight, took place in 1850 in France. And that was using like a hot air balloon. We all know and love the classic hot air balloon. But people had a much larger imagination for what flight could be. So there was a lot of open talk. It's not like today where a lot of things are taken off the table. There was talk of anti-gravity, what we would call anti-gravity type mechanisms and things like that. So people were searching for the answer to flight, controlled flight, through all measures. There was an account that Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, received a letter from these two inventors that they had a controlled aircraft that they wanted to demonstrate for him. And this supposedly took place in D.C., and there was a newspaper article accounting it. And at no point do they describe a hot air balloon. They describe like two long cylinders, some sort of like substructure of just like metal with like a pilot seat and all this. In this report, they said that this thing flew, a controlled flight. And this was reported back to Lincoln. This is where I think the mystery kind of starts, is that this might be the first skunk works, like 1860s skunk works taking place where the government's getting a piece of technology. This might be where it kind of starts, where the secrecy at least of it begins.
Yeah, I think that's a good point and something worth mentioning, which is that the military and the government, they often have technology in their hands that it's at least outpacing the human
the general population at about a 50-year rate. Like, there's been reports that in the 50s that they had AI back then, but we're just now experiencing it today. And some of those other things. So it wouldn't surprise me at all, to your point, if that was happening in 1860, that almost 40 years go by, and now we're actually seeing that technology in use and possible testing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Some of the people that I've researched through this, and I want to put this out there, just they're great sources. And this is where everything that's jumbled up in my head right now comes from. But people like Walter Bosley, Joseph Farrell, the book here I got right now is J. Allen Danilek. I think it was Walter Bosley who brought up the South used the first submarine, the Hunley, to sink a ship. Now, if they would have kept that secret, where would a sub technology, how far could it have gone before we would have all realized that there were submarines in this world? So that's something to kind of think about. Like, there was extreme advances taking place at that time because of the war. And this one, I think, just managed to kind of stay secret. I think whatever these aircraft, this is my personal opinion, but whatever aircraft that Edwin Stanton and Abe Lincoln witnessed, that technology might have just taken a lot. It might have been not the best time for it to work on it now during the war, just with resources being what they were. But yeah, given another 30, 40 years, where would this have gone? And we kind of see this in 1897. I think.
Absolutely. What you were describing sounds a lot like what people reported during those first sightings, as far as the mechanical details, the propellers, the framework. That goes in line with what people were claiming that they were seeing in the sky. And it was just so many people across such a wide area telling different versions of the same story. And in a lot of those initial reports, were able to verify that we had some really credible witnesses who had seen this craft and gave really good, solid, strong accounts. Media of the time, there wasn't TV, there wasn't radio. A lot of people, they got their news and entertainment from newspapers. So it was a very cutthroat business. And if that initial story that landed in the Sacramento Bee was a hoax, it's very likely that another newspaper would have called them out for it to, you know, monopolize on that and take some of their business. But we didn't see that happen. And from what I saw, there was nobody claiming, at least in the media, that this was a hoax. This was described as very real events. And so we see that there was no other newspapers that took an opportunity to call this thing out as a hoax. And at the time, newspapers, they did run stories called serials, which would be sort of in comparison to like a TV show for us today, where we have episodes and then you have the dramatic, season finale. So newspapers would do something similar. They would post an outlandish story, but they would come out and they'd say, hey, this is a serial. And then that was kind of the gag. But that never happened with this. This was reported as fact. And even if the newspapers were going to publish something false, it would be really easy for a competing competitor to go, hey, nobody by that name lives in this town. But these were real people who were really seeing this phenomenon.
Yeah. And also the phenomenon took a break for about 2 months after the initial November, December, January sightings in California. This was a huge media news. This was huge. People were paying attention to this. Then the sightings stopped for 2 months. If this was a media hoax, or if this was something kind of being drummed up, why would there be a lag in reports then all of a sudden? And then when they do pick up again, it's in a different part of the country. Now it's in the Midwest, especially all the way down to Texas. And that's why it being a hoax entirely, I just don't think that it could be.
So when you started digging into these early reports, what immediately stood out to you about these first sightings? What details did you find strange?
There's actually a lot of sightings of the occupants of these, not really sightings, but encounters with them. Now, there is a few that are people describe at the time, they would call them Martians. And we can probably talk about the Aurora, Texas one here in a bit, because that one was particularly described as being a Martian. But for the most part, a lot of the sightings of the occupants or meetings of the occupants, they're just regular people. And that's what kind of blew my mind, is that these people are coming off and they're just talking very cavalier, like as if it's not a secret. For example, in April 1897, J.P. Lingen and his son went to inspect some lights in a nearby pasture and found four men standing next to a large dark object who asked him for water. One man said that his name was Wilson and that this was his ship and only five aircraft constructed in secret. It had four legs. It had four large wings like dragonfly propellers and its bow and stern. The next day, Sheriff H.W. Baylor met three men outside an airship that had landed behind his house in Uvalde, Texas, and one identified himself as Wilson of Goshen, New York. And there were at least three other incidents in Texas involving Wilson and other similar events. So there was, it's not like a UFO's landing and aliens coming out. It's just some guy's coming out and he just needs water. And I guess water was something that the craft needed. So take note of that. It does require some sort of resource to keep it going.
Right. That's really interesting. We have actual reports of landings and people going up and expecting the ship and being brought on and having these full-blown conversations. It wasn't just something that they saw quickly moving by in the sky.
Yeah, this is a completely different experience. This is having a drink or having a smoking a pipe with someone that landed a seemingly impossible craft in your town or in your backyard.
I think we mentioned it in the beginning of how this gets categorized under the UFO wave. And when you hear researchers talk about UFO history, you will hear terms like flap and wave, and those are similar, but they're not the exact same thing.
Yeah. Like, for example, the San Francisco sighting, very early on, when I first started hearing about this, I always heard that being compared to the Battle of Los Angeles, but in 1896 or whatever. But then to find out why it was nothing like that, not just because of the lack of armaments being shot at it, but because it's a completely different thing that people are looking at. They're seeing something completely different.
I think that that is what helps define those things, because the UFO flap would refer to an intense cluster of sightings over a specific area for a short period of time, which that could fall under the Battle of Los Angeles, because they're often described as being more chaotic and it triggers immediate media attention or even sometimes military interest and public concern. But then just as suddenly as they came, they fade. And for me to find something comparable to, it's kind of like when we were seeing those drones over New Jersey last year or the year before, and it was like they came and then they disappeared as suddenly as they were in the media. They were gone just as fast. Whereas when we talk about the UFO wave, that describes that broader pattern, which involves sightings that are spread across those larger regions. Like here, we mentioned the 19 states and sometimes even entire countries, but and this can last for months or even years. So rather than it just being one hotspot in California, we're seeing these reports repeated, and they follow that similar description and behavior over time, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and I believe with the drone situation, like in New Jersey, didn't the FAA say they were testing something? That was the ultimate.
I think they did come out and say that. Yeah, that's right. It was a test. And I personally, hot take on that, I think it was a psychological test.
I would agree with that. I think it's as much psychological as it was. Maybe they were testing something. And the connection with that, with the airship mystery, is that this J. Allen Danilik, who wrote the book The Great Airship of 1897, A Provocative Look at the Most Mysterious Aviation Event in History, he theorized that it was a more conventional hot air balloon system, but he theorized that they were prototyping some sort of transit system. That's why it started up on the West Coast, and you had this influx for a few months of all these possibly, hey, maybe that Wilson was right, maybe five aircraft that are flying, testing out the waters, if you may, but seeing how these things actually operate over the coast. And then you have a break for a few months, which is enough time to make some adjustments, figure things out, and then you pop up in the middle of the country. And all of a sudden you have all these paths. So much like the New Jersey UAP drone situation, as they said, it was just a test of some sort. Well, this is very similar to what the airships were doing. You're having these clusters.
When you talk about it requiring water, what are some of the theories around what was powering them? When we talk about it, the testing, yeah, it might not be UFO in nature. It could absolutely just be us testing out some advanced technology for that time. I've heard that the airships were a better form of transportation than current airplanes, and it would have been a lot cheaper and travel would have been much more affordable for people. Whereas the airplanes are set up today, it's gas and it is a big money maker. Obviously, there's so much money in oil that this was just not a way for the powers that be to make any money off of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if they were to, no matter what time period, if they would have came across a technology that didn't require an expensive fuel, the same rules apply today.
What are your theories on how the craft was powered?
Well, there's a lot of people, from what I've gathered, those different viewpoints. Some say, well, that could be a steam engine. For example, that J. Allen Danilek, he kind of believes that it was probably some sort of steam engine that they were requiring. Other researchers like Walter Bosley, Joseph Farrell, concluded, and this is based on, I guess we're getting to the Charles Darshall artwork, they theorized that there was some sort of anti-gravity. And this goes into the Die Glock, the Nazi Die Glock Bell theories too. And so he theorized that it was some sort of reactor, and possibly it was like a crystal or a liquid ruby mixture. One of the people that he's researched into, which was Charles Darshall, and it might have been the Wilson fellow from Goshen, New York, mentioned some sort of green soup is what runs it. Now, the Wilson, who mentioned he was Goshen, New York connection, there was a connection to an aero club. And there was these aero clubs all over America because people were trying to invent aircraft. So, like, in California, you had the Sonero Aero Club. And that was around during the Great Airship Invasion of San Francisco. That had existed. And there was connections to this other group in New York, which the only documents that ever named them was in Charles Darshall's drawings. And he was like an inventor, engineer kind of guy. But all this stuff almost got thrown out, and they found these books, and they're almost like blueprints. Not quite, though. It's almost like abstract artistic blueprints of these aircrafts, these strange airships and hot air balloons. But he was a member of the Sonero Aero Club, which had a connection with this group called NIMSA. And he wrote NIMSA on a lot of the paperwork. And this was like a German aero club. So all these aero clubs were kind of out and around. And there was different clubs who were focusing on different things. There was no, the brain wasn't locked in on like, okay, we have to build a wing. Like, no one knew how to fly. So everyone was trying stuff. In some of this Charles Darshall's drawings is a bell-shaped craft with some sort of reactor in the middle. And it also has the weird writings on the kind of the outer. It looks very much like an acorn or a bell. And then you look at modern day or more modern discoveries of like the documents for the Die Glock, the Nazi piece of equipment, whether it was a time machine or an anti-gravity motor. And then that has connections with the Kecksburg UFO crash, which was described as being acorn. And all this stuff kind of lines up with a timeline that exists that goes all the way back to that 1860s.
So that reminds me that on episode 16, I covered the time slip files where we talk about Sergei. And that was part of what he had captured on his camera in Ukraine as he had taken a picture. And they say that in the photo has the Nazi bell, and that because it was going across the frame at the time he snapped the photo, that was actually the reason why he time traveled into the future.
Interesting. Interesting. Because the bell has connections to the Philadelphia experiment, as its connections go deep in lore.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if they were also testing out some sort of time traveling or transportation technology, and all of these little time slips really do all go back to that Black Book project.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it also changes his perspective on Operation Paperclip, because we always look at it as like, oh, well, we got all these Nazi scientists. The truth of it is we actually got all these people back. A lot of them were already over here. And so it's odd that a technology that we see drawn up in America in the 1890s, in the early 1900s, and then we see it come to fruition in World War II in Germany. And there's a connection to a German aero club to start it all off. And that's the route, I don't know if that's the truth of it, but that's the route I find the most interesting. Just because that object comes up, and it's drawn so much. And then I'm from Pennsylvania, so the Kecksburg thing was always a very relevant, strange mystery. To have kind of nearby you. And it's also described almost exactly the same way. And that would line up with like testing. Like, okay, we acquired this tech in World War II, and now here we are testing it here in the 60s. I think 58 was that one.
So that brings it to the big question, which is, what were these things?
I guess we'll start with the most grounded one, which is that these were experimental better-than-air aircraft that were being developed and tested. We just didn't see that technology pick up again for another decade or two. I've completely forgot to bring something up. You know what today is? It's the 122nd birthday of the first flight in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Isn't that weird?
No way. What a synchronicity. Yeah.
Very strange synchronicity.
Wow. It's like the airship gods have blessed us.
I know. I meant to bring that up in the beginning and it completely slipped my mind.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it. That is really an interesting tie-in.
Yeah. That was very strange.
I think that that was one of the more popular explanations at the time. And even now, a lot of people think that this was a human-made ship and that it was just the idea of that private inventor group, the air clubs that you're talking about, that they were all trying to test it and crack powered flight way before the Wright brothers took off. Did you say 122 years ago?
Yeah, today? 122 years ago today.
Yeah, so it's possible that they tried to keep it quiet because supporters of the theory, they point to some of the more of the mechanical descriptions and how it was a controlled movement that it required somebody being in there to move the pedals. Like you said, get the water. There's some reports of the occupants referring to themselves as inventors. That does raise the question, which is if someone had this level of technology, why demonstrate it over popular areas where someone could potentially steal your idea and patent it before you could? How plausible do you think that the secret inventor theory is?
I think it's totally possible, especially at that time period. It's not like today where an idea gets out there and it's instantly put out there for criticism and everything else. People are just sitting in their barns building stuff. If you're an inventor, especially a lot of these people were engineers and architects, so they had knowledge. When a mind's kind of leashed to like figure out how to figure out powered flight, I would imagine that you come up with some very interesting ideas.
I would have loved to have seen some of the original prototypes. And it's interesting just even how far we've come in the last 122 years. Like that is mind-blowing in and of itself.
I mean, just 70 years after this event, we landed on the moon. Well, there's mysterious inventors, but then there's also these sightings where it's moving 200 miles per hour. That would eliminate any lighter than an aircraft. This would be something that's distinctly a controlled aircraft. This goes into mysterious inventors, into super mysterious inventors with top secret, highly advanced technology that they're dabbling in. Some sort of anti-gravity, some sort of levitational effect is being produced. Stuff like mercury, the green soup stuff, or even like a red soup, which is a ruby mixture, liquid ruby, being spun around some system. A lot of these drawings will show these containers of a fluid. If this was some sort of technology that was more in line with anti-gravity, then we're getting interesting. Then we're getting to a reason why this might have dropped off the map and got really quiet very fast. Even at that time, like you mentioned with the UAPs in New Jersey, it could have been just as much psychological as it was testing technology. How will people react to aircraft flying over them?
Yeah, because at that point in time, too, there was no light pollution. It was not like the USA that we have today. It was still very much being developed. So at night when they were going out and seeing these lights in the sky and these crafts being sometimes 100 feet off the ground, they were able to really clearly go out there and see. They weren't being misidentified either.
Yeah. And they often times followed either Union Pacific rail lines or the telegraph lines. That was another thing that correlated with a lot of these sightings that happened across the nation.
I think that's an interesting piece because witnesses describe seeing a searchlight. I think that would be a time without GPS and without really good maps. So if you followed the railways, you could make your way probably to the East Coast.
Yeah, that would be your straightest shot and most likely like the your best chance because it would always take the lowest grade and it would always be the straightest shot that you can go. But I would imagine that if no matter what the craft was, it just in the infancy of its creation, there had to be something to control. It'd probably be pretty scary if these were these guys' first couple times taking these things out.
Yeah, not knowing how it would react and what it would do. And especially if this was some secret anti-gravity tech.
Oh, yeah. And then this is where we get into like the breakaway civilization aspect of it, which I also find endlessly fascinating. Were these inventors, did they take their technology and go someplace else? Did they abandon us and leave us?
Yes, let's get into that. Because when we talk about UFO or this being classified as an early UFO wave before that term ever even existed, because these were technically unidentified flying objects at that time, but the people, the occupants inside, they weren't described as little green men or even like Nordics or anything like that. They just appear to be normal looking people, to your point, just regular inventors. That's where it gets into the hidden people of our reality and breakaway civilization. So yes, please take us down that rabbit hole.
April 19th in the Dallas Morning News. On April 18th, Judge Love of Wacachi, Texas, claimed he met five strangely dressed men smoking pipes in repose by a landed aircraft. The men said they were from the land beyond the polar seas and that they were descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Their craft were cigar-shaped with three pairs of flapping wings. And then the next day was April 19th, and the next day was the crash in Aurora, Texas. And Aurora, Texas is one of the bigger events of the entire 1897 airship mystery. Because that one crashed into a windmill, allegedly. And the occupant, I believe the chaplain and the sheriff there in that town, said that this was not human, that it was a Martian is what they concluded it to be. And they gave it a proper Christian burial and buried the parts of the craft out back someone's barn somewhere. But that was the next day after this other incident in this same region. They said that the pilot was badly burned in the Aurora crash. So this might have been just them thinking that this was an alien. They might have never seen an aircraft before. And obviously someone had Martians on their brain. Because I find it odd that this must have been something that's in America at the time, which is that aliens were just Martians. Like, they all came from Mars. Because you see that repeatedly. People are saying they were Martians.
Somebody mentioned in one of the reports that the occupants said that they were from Mars in one of the cases.
That was during the San Francisco rush. There was someone who said that it was four blue aliens, and they said they were Martians. Many witnesses claim that they spoke to the pilots of the land. The first pilot encounter came just 2 days after the first sighting over Sacramento on November 19th. Colonel H.G. Shaw claimed to have encountered two tall, lanky Martians who flew away silently in a football shaped aircraft. Although this story is likely a hoax, hoaxes directed at uncritical readers were common in 19th century newspaper, but later stories of close encounters weren't also far-fetched. So that one's up in the air whether or not it's true or not.
I'd like to go back to the report you shared that was in the Texas newspaper, because when they talk about lands from the north and being a breakaway tribe, that's a lot to unpack there. And that theory, when we talk about the hidden people, that kind of gets into the idea that there could be potential extra land that's out there that we haven't discovered. And that gets into Bird's diaries with Antarctica and going and saying, okay, there is this ice wall, and over the ice wall, there's extra land, there's more continents, and there is life, and there are people, which kind of dives into not a extraterrestrial theory with this case, but a crypto-terrestrial theory, because a crypto-terrestrial, that is a highly advanced, intelligent being or civilization that secretly lives here on Earth. For example, up north in extra land, and they're often linked with those UFO and UAP stories. So it does suggest that there are these hidden entities that are native here to Earth that could be part of that breakaway civilization. And this could be part of that population.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the extra land kind of theory, because I'm not like fully on board with the flat Earth, but something that I find, I enjoy the topic, because there's a lot you could think critically about. And there is something that they censor that involves flat Earth. Like, there is some level of censorship going on with that all. Same with Tartaria. And I don't go completely in on any of those theories, but I think the thing to take away from it is that I think what they're trying to keep secret is the extra land theory, is that there is some place of solitude at the poles, most likely, because this is where everything seems to always end up at the poles when you're going down this anti-gravity mystery. There's always some reference to it.
Interesting. Like, that's the common denominator.
It seems to pop up. Yeah. Especially like once we start getting into the 20th century, all of a sudden there's a rush for the poles. All of a sudden, the Nazis are building a base down there. Admiral Byrd's going down there right after the war. Now, we go down there. We keep people stationed there constantly. Everyone does.
Yeah. It makes you wonder if it is some sort of entryway or exit. It's just fascinating that there's absolutely no flights over Antarctica. You can't do it. There's no flights over either of the poles, I don't believe. And speaking specifically about Antarctica, it is so heavily surveilled. You can't even go there by boat if you were just wanting to be a tourist or go investigate yourself. You're going to get like a Blackhawk and probably some very stern orders. You just can't go there and explore willy-nilly.
It's also the size of Antarctica. It's hard to imagine. You can see it on a globe, but start putting like, when you actually look at the scale of it, like how big a McMurdo Station is, that whole area, that whole peninsula, it's massive. I mean, it's the size of a state here, you know, of a large state here in America, just that one little portion. So like we're dealing with an area that's so large, that's so brutal. All it would need is a small pocket of warm air and lush forest hidden in the midst of all that, where you have an oasis. And if we can get really crazy, maybe there's some sort of portal in the polar regions.
No, absolutely. And we've been so lied to, and our viewpoint has been so obscured that even when looking at a map, that even on a psychological level, that they printed the United States bigger and larger, and they made other continents like Europe and Africa appear a lot smaller.
Like America looks like it's the size of like the Sahara Desert. But in reality, right, you could fit like three Americas in the Sahara Desert. It's massive.
Yeah, so a lot of our maps are just point of view is skewed. When you talk about the size of Antarctica, I don't even think we can really wrap our brain around how large it is. I mean, Alaska takes up half of our country. It's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ginormous. And then to think that it's all just frozen ice and there's nothing else out there when we know it's volcanically active. Going to like hollow earth, whether you want to go into like the Agartha stuff or just kind of more of a sponge kind of earth where there's just a lot of caverns and cavities throughout it where civilizations could exist. Again, you have this giant landmass where all that could be there.
I have seen that the moon is a holograph of Earth. And if you were to take what you see on the moon and put it on the globe, but there's extra land, like a lot of extra land. Like we're just a tiny little, like you said, like a little pocket on there. And then around us is extra continents. So I've heard that. And then like, as it relates to today's topic though, if these were hidden breakaway civilizations, what do you think they were doing? Why make the journey? Why potentially expose yourself like that?
I think that's why there was a sudden stop in this. Because if this was technology being prototyped, which does seem like it is, if it was going to be aimed at commercial travel for just regular people, we would have seen that technology continue to grow in front of our eyes. Instead, we have this 8-month pocket where we're seeing these ships that are doing things that aren't exactly what Zeppelins were able to do and exceeded what hot air balloons could do. You're seeing this technology all of a sudden stop and clamp down. And it makes me wonder, this club of aero pilots, did they all get together and go, like, we should explore? There was aero clubs all over the world at that time. So it would only take, like, one of those clubs to discover maybe some great place where they all just went to, took their loved ones, took what they had, and escaped. And then we see these little drops of this technology that appear throughout the decades. Just little drops of it.
Why do you think that someone or a group with this level of technology would choose to fly it so openly over towns instead of remaining hidden?
I think because at that point, they weren't even at that thinking plot yet of just, oh, we should keep this secret. I think we got a glimpse of it before someone said, hey, we should probably not be doing this publicly. We're getting a lot of attention here. So I think we got like just that 8-month period was just a little glimpse and a birthing of a new technology, and then it just disappeared. Or did it?
Did they go on to continue testing it in secret?
Yeah, because even people in 1890s, even a lot of these inventors of these in these aero clubs, they were working out. They were trying to figure out life support systems. They were talking about landing on Mars. They were talking about landing on the moon. This is the 19th century. And these people were drawing up plans and trying to think of ways. So you had that mindset that didn't get picked up again for another 60 years or so, we're led to believe.
Do you lean towards one explanation, or are you sitting with the uncertainty?
I guess I have to sit with the uncertainty because I just don't know what I want it to be. And what I think interests my brain the most is that there was these group of inventors making some really wild stuff, really ahead of its time. And it's got snuck to the background. And now all these UFO sightings, because this technology, like as it's grown, Walter Bozzi kind of brings up a great point. In the 1860, you have a Model T version of this technology. Then when you get to 1897, that wave, you get more of like a 50s Buick. And now when you get to the 40s with like David Arnold sightings of the saucers, now we're getting to like Corvettes. We're getting into something nice. Now we're at where we're seeing just all kinds of stuff in the air. So you see a growth of technology that's acting the same.
How does that change the way that you look at history or unexplained phenomena? Because the story feels like it has some level of cover up going on, because although it was reported in the media, there's really no clear answers. Like, how does that change the way that you look at our history of itself if this has been omitted?
That's a good question. Well, it makes me relook at everything. It changes my perspective on everything we've accomplished up until that point. If we did go to the moon, it's more about the technology that we used to get there. I think that was the lie. So if this technology was used in conjunction to achieve these kind of little things but kept secret, that's very deceiving. So it makes me very critical of what I'm told that we have and what we don't have. I'm critical of what I'm being told that is possible, because I don't think what we're being told is possible is the limit. I think impossible is out there. And I think this airship mystery kind of put that out there. It kind of put that in the front page for a little while. If there was these advancements that it just existed and then they were wiped out, and is this just the us picking up the pieces and putting it together over the last couple hundred years? Because the bell thing is very odd to me. It was with the drawings of the bell, then you get the die Glock.
I think it's the concepts that lie within, which have to do with this erasure of history. And I've seen some people even theorize that what we know about the 1800s is very obscured, and that there could even be some missing time. Mm-hmm. A set of time specifically taken out of there. And I mean, this is around the time when we were having these world's fairs that were very suspicious as far as the technological feats that we saw there and how quickly that technology came and went. I think for me, it just, as always, leaves me with more questions than really answers that I'm going to be satisfied with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I love the Great Airship Mystery, because it the implications of it, it's quite grand when you really see it. And there's something about just that period of time where people got to see it. People got to see something kind of beyond the veil, a lost technology maybe being rebirthed.
It's totally possible.
Oh, I don't remember the exact case, but I want to say this happened during the Midwest. Again, I don't remember the details because they're not right in front of me. But there was a guy who was driving and came across an airship that was parked on the road kind of a little bit. And he had to drive the pilots into town, and they were just regular dudes. And I remember listening to this kind of account and thinking, man, that's something. Like, these guys don't even know the implications of what they have. And the people who are picking up don't even understand the implications of what they have. They have a couple of drinks, he gets some water, and they head back to the airship and they take off and fly away. And that to me is like so fascinating, because why lie about this? And what would this garner for anybody?
That's a good point, especially when we talk about how credible these witnesses were. They were government officials. I think even some senators had witnessed it too. So these people who were reporting these things weren't in positions to just get swept up in mass hysteria of Martian and Mars and lie and hoax this. I think it would just take too much cooperation. Because if we look at it from the hoaxing angle, and it's like, okay, if this was a hoax, and sure, if we look at the totality of all the stories, just like even with Bigfoot or anything else, there's going to be people who lie just to be a part of the action. They want their 5 minutes of fame. So I'm sure that there are some outliers. That just like with anything, there's always going to be outliers. But story. When you look at the stories, you look at the consistent details. I think even, to your point of how the cluster kind of moved, the coordination that would take, like, okay, guys, we're going to start in California, everybody lie. And to just at that point in time, when pre-cell phones, pre-computers, to try to get everybody on the same page when you're sending telegraphs, like, hey, let's string together this fantastic hoax.
And there's accounts of these things landing and near the post office and sending telegraphs and letters.
So it was,
you know, and this really started a big, you know, this inspired a lot of H.G. Wells, these accounts and all that going into his stories. And it just opened them. I think a lot of the American, like, what do you call it? The zeitgeist kind of, it opened their minds up. And back then people, like I was saying earlier, there's nothing off the table. People talked about anti-gravity openly, like trying to figure out how to levitate. And there wasn't anything restricting the human mind back then. And I think that's what fascinates me about that time period particularly, was just like it was open. The gates were open. Think up whatever you want to think up. Try whatever you want to try.
Yeah, so that is an interesting part of the story. Just the cooperation I think it would take to get all these people together to lie, that would be just too grand. I really do believe that those initial reports and how we saw it documented over time, I'm inclined to believe that those were legitimate. And now whether that was us testing technology, if we were seeing a group of inventors testing something before their time, or if it was our hidden people theory, people were definitely seeing and experiencing something.
Yeah, it was definitely a real event. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah, definitely was. And I think that this is just one of those forgotten human chapters. It just reminds us that something far stranger is going on and that history still has these blind spots that people just aren't as familiar with or talk about, and that I'm so happy that we get to cover.
But yeah. In this case, this kind of got jumbled up with historical UFO documents when it's really not that, even though technically it is, but in terms of terminology, but it's different than just UFO sightings. This is something different. This is us figuring something out.
I just feel like there's so many pieces of this puzzle that this could go in so many different directions. But you have a lot of different theories that kind of intersect here. And it's like, okay, which one do we go?
Yeah, exactly. And that's another reason why I really love this mystery, is like all the different avenues you can take and the implications for all the different things that could have went from here. I would recommend, whether it's Walter Bosley or Joseph Farrell, or it's someone who's like really in depth with this, because it is such an interesting, there's so many details, so many names involved.
Well, and I think you could take different pieces of this case and just spend an hour doing a case study or longer on that specific theory. I mean, the hidden people, the Nazi Bell theory, when we talk about the hidden lands, we only just touched the surface on some of those things because it's just so much material there.
Yeah, I mean, it really encompasses almost a little bit of everything.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing your research and your insight tonight. I'm so excited you were able to come on and share it with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been really great. The reason why I wanted to do this was because the airship thing kept kind of popping up. We talked about it briefly in the episode I did with you. And then it came up a few more times on different episodes of Dark Florida. So it was great to finally get like a little deep dive in on it. Thanks for having me.
And that's where we'll leave the skies of the 1890s for this week. The Great Airship Mystery reminds us that long before modern aircraft and long before we had words like UFO, people were already looking up and witnessing something they couldn't explain. Now, whether these airships were secret inventions, an elaborate hoax, or misidentified technology, or just part of a much larger phenomena, one thing is clear. The unknown didn't begin in the modern age. It's always been with us. I want to give a huge thank you to my guest, MK Ultra, aka Michael Kirkpatrick, for joining me tonight and helping me bring this strange chapter of history back into the light. I will be sure to drop his links in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this week's episode, make sure you're following Dark Florida on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast. And you can also watch investigations in full video episodes on YouTube at youtube.com/@DarkFlorida411. 1. If you have an encounter, a story you'd like to share, or if you're interested in being a guest on the show, you can email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. And if you would like to support Dark Florida, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida, or wherever you're listening, drop that 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. So keep questioning, keep exploring, and remember, sometimes the strangest mysteries are hiding right above us. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange. Thank you.